Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And our editor at large, Jamie Graham.
Hello.
Hello. So this week we are looking at Pixar's latest Lightyear. We're appraising sex comedy Good Luck to You, Leo Grand, seeing if Cha-Cha Real Smooth has all the right moves, and weighing up end-of-life drama Everything Went Fine. But first of all, lads, what have you been watching this week?
I've had a mixture of TV and films this week, as per usual. I caught up with season two of Hacks, which was wonderful, which if you haven't seen yet, I really do recommend you see, kind of comics on the road. Very funny, bitter, true to life, really good. So I recommend
Sounds like
that.
You're describing yourself there.
I am pretty much. That's probably why I like it, to be honest. I also caught up with season four of Stranger Things, which I'm a bit behind the curve on that. And I know everyone adores it and thinks it's the best one since the first one, but it really didn't do much for me. I'm just kind of losing interest. I must say I absolutely adored the first season and I've kind of gradually gone off it ever since. But I pushed through that. And then cinema-wise, I went back to the cinema yesterday to see Top Gun Maverick for the third time. It just gets better and better, but don't even get me going on that because we all know how much I adore that film. And I've also been watching a few old classics. I went back to Psycho, Mr. Hitchcock, and a few others. I'm basically trying to compose at the moment a top 10 list of top 10 films of all time, which of course is absolutely impossible, but I've been asked to do it. So I have 8 titles that are absolutely locked, and for the other 2 places I'm kind of revisiting a bunch of my favorite movies to see which ones kind of chime with me most at the moment, because obviously films change as you get older. So I want to sort of make sure it's the right list for right now. So that's what I've been doing.
I mean, Stand By Me is totally in there though, right?
Stand By Me is my favourite movie of all time. The thing is, there's a difference between greatest movies and favourite movies. It's a very thin line. But no, it is. But Stand By Me is my favourite. But would I say Stand By Me is as great a movie as something like 2001 A Space Odyssey? I wouldn't, but it is my favourite.
Interesting. Okay. Jordan, not making a top 10 list. What are you doing?
I like the rest of the planet, seemingly. I've been watching Obi-Wan Kenobi and Miss Marvel, of course, enjoying both of those. But it was also Sundance London last week. Most of the films that played, it played across the country, not just in London. So most of the films that were there, Jane, you and I saw most of them back at Sundance in January, virtual Sundance from our Sofaplex. But I revisited a film called Hatching ahead of interviewing that film's director, Hannah Bergholm. It's a Finnish horror film, Bergholm's first feature. It's about a young gymnast with this overbearing social media obsessed mother who finds an enormous egg. From this egg emerges a hideous bird-like creature. And then the young girl and this bird-like creature start to develop this intense, very dangerous sort of connection. And I thought it was really, really terrific sort of debut feature, very stylish, very assured with some very sort of icky puppetry and animatronic work. Really reminded me of, you know, Cronenberg's 80s output and his most recent output, Crown of the Future.
Which does look very icky. I haven't seen that, but I'm looking forward to it. The vile sort of operations and people with lots of ears on them, that is to come. But shall we look now what we can watch this week, because there's a couple of pretty good ones out. Should we strap in for Lightspeed? It's this.
Buzz Lightyear mission log. After a full year of being marooned on this planet, our first test flight is a go. Let's get everyone home.
Good luck, Captain.
We're all counting on you!
Roger that.
There's a star. So this is Lightyear, Jamie. I mean, we've all seen Toy Story. We know who Buzz Lightyear is. But how does this fit into the Toy Story canon?
Well, it's essentially an origin movie. And it's a really clever idea for an origin movie that... Basically, this film we're about to watch and we're now talking about today, Lightyear, is the film that Andy, who's obviously the protagonist in the Toy Story movies, the human protagonist, the little boy, it's the film that Andy fell in love with, and it was his favourite movie in 1995 when the first Toy Story came out. So the idea is that Andy would have seen this movie. This movie would have launched a toy range, as all big movies do, and he would have got the toy Buzz Lightyear for Christmas or his birthday, and that is why he has that toy to go with all his other playthings, which then make the Toy Story movie. So that is the idea. And what it is, it's an animated movie, and Buzz Lightyear, we find him on a spaceship with 1,200 people, big crew, and they're in uncharted space when the movie opens, and they receive messages from a distant planet that there's life forms on this planet. So they go into land to investigate. All the scientists stay asleep, they're all in their pods, and the space rangers led by Buzz Lightyear go off onto the planet to have a little nose around, and they find that it's a hostile planet full of vegetation, like roots and plants and vines that are a bit like an Evil Dead. They come out and grab you and try and get you. Lots of scuttling bugs. And long story short, they get stranded on the planet. And the whole movie is them stranded on the planet for many years, and Buzz trying to make some stable fuel so they can travel at light speed and get back to planet Earth. So that is what the movie is.
And is it any good? Is it a film that you will have dear to your heart like Andy does?
Not dear to my heart. I think it's solid. I mean, the animation is absolutely incredible. I enjoyed the characters. I enjoyed hanging out with Buzz and the various kind of crew and people around him. He has a robot cat, which is like a companion called Sox. And he, absolutely magnificent. I loved him. He was my favourite character in the film. Every time he sort of purred and opened his mouth and spoke, I just fell in love with him. He's going to be the toy that all the kids want this Christmas. So there was things I really liked about it, but unfortunately, I just found the story really quite bland. It's a bit like The Martian, that they're stuck on this planet and Buzz is trying to develop this fuel. And then there's an attack by Emperor Zurg, who we all know from the Toy Story films, the big antagonist. Him and his Cyclops army kind of invade. And that probably sounds really exciting that they're having a battle off this army. But it all just felt really kind of standard and rote to me, and stuff you've seen in a million sci-fi films. And it's sort of it kind of plodded along, and I found it a bit drawn out, and it never really engaged me. So the mystery for me is why this would be Andy's favourite movie of all time. I suppose he is a kid, you know, he's, you know, 10 years old or whatever when he saw it. So maybe, but the director of this film, Angus MacLane, he's kind of said that he was inspired by all the 70s and 80s sci-fi movies, that he felt Andy would have discovered this movie on VHS, but it would have been around since the late 70s, early 80s. But by saying that, you immediately think of those great movies like Spielberg's E.T., Close Encounters. You think of Alien, you think of The Thing, Star Wars, obviously 1977, Blade Runner 1982. You know, this is the era this movie's meant to have come from. And it's kind of setting yourself up for a fall, really, because the moment you start to compare this film to any of those, you know, it comes up very, very short. But I think it's just a solid Pixar movie, like 3 stars for me. Unfortunately, with Pixar, you want more than that, obviously. You know, they've kind of raised the bar and you really want them to hit 4 or 5 stars every time. And this, for me, is one of their more disappointing efforts.
Jordan, did it go to infinity and beyond for you? It does star your favourite, Chris Evans, Cap himself, as the voice of Buzz Lightyear. Did it do it for you?
It does, yeah. Chris Evans obviously rather controversially replacing Tim Allen as the voice of Buzz in this film, for reasons which sort of make sense in the context of the film, although I did enjoy this slightly more than Jamie, I think. I'm sort of predisposed, I guess, to liking any sort of big, hard sci-fi swings on screen. And I thought this did a pretty good job of capturing that. I don't know, to me, it felt less like a film from the 70s and 80s than it did like a sort of 70s paperback book, like one of those fairly disposable hard sci-fi short stories. I really love that. There are some big, real high concept ideas in this, a few of which will be familiar to you if you've seen quite a few big sci-fi films over the last few years, not least of which is Christopher Nolan's Interstellar, which this film steals a big idea from. There are some really fun concepts in here, though. Like, I love the Cyclops. They have these teleporting devices which transport them back to their mothership, but always to this one spot, and they use that in some really sort of fun and creative ways. And there are some nice ideas with Zerg, which I didn't see coming, which I was glad that they took some big swings with it. The thing that annoyed me a little bit about it was I just felt the whole thing felt conceptually flawed on one level, because they go to lengths at the beginning to explain that this is, you know, this is Andy's favorite film. He saw it in 1995. The Buzz Lightyear toys, the Zerg toys are all based on this film. But then, for one, there aren't any Sox toys, which makes no sense, because surely everyone would want a Sox toy. Or Hawthorne,
who is, you know, like his female sort of boss, who's badass.
Where are the other Space Ranger toys in Andy's world? And the other issue is that a lot of his catchphrases from the film just aren't in this film. Like, you know, this is a secret mission to uncharted space or whatever. That's just not part of this film. So where does that catchphrase come from in this toy?
Like, a sequel. This sets it up for a sequel, doesn't it? So
there's Lightyear 2.
Maybe we're keeping the powder dry for that, do you reckon?
But the fact that these things are sort of going through my head as I was watching it is probably not the best sign that I was fully engaged with this film. But as Jamie said, I thought this looked completely beautiful. I loved the kind of grainy, washed out color palette on this alien world. I thought that the team that he sort of assembles around him of wannabe space rangers, I really grew to like that little bunch of people. Among them are Kiki Layne and Taika Waititi plays one of them. They're very funny. And I found that some of the set pieces were quite thrilling in a kind of right stuff first man kind of way, because at one point in the film, he becomes this sort of test pilot for this experimental fuel. And I found all that stuff like really quite exciting as he's, you know, pushing the boundaries of what he can do in this ship. I thought they captured all that stuff really well. But I'm totally on the same page as Jamie in the sense I don't think the story is quite there with this one, and especially with Pixar, you know. That said, I don't think Pixar have been at the top of their game for a number of years now. I don't think they've produced an all-timer probably since Inside Out. Even still, this doesn't feel anywhere near top tier Pixar in terms of what they're doing in terms of the storytelling, but I would be lying if I said that I didn't enjoy myself in the cinema.
Yeah, it's a good time, you know, and it's a studio that's producing really good quality content. I mean, this isn't going to sort of bore parents that have to take kids, and it's certainly not going to completely disappoint people who love the Toy Story franchise. But yeah, you're right. I have to say I agree with you guys. It didn't move me. It didn't touch me emotionally. There's a sequence at the beginning that I found almost to an up level of like, Jesus, you've really got me there. And then it never got that again. And I felt strangely emotionally detached from what was going on screen. And that whole sequence that you're talking about with Buzz, you know, pushing his plane to Mach whatever. I don't think he actually was pushing it to Mach 9, but it reminded me of old Maverick in his ship trying to get his Mach 10.
10.1.
Yeah. 10.2. So as you say, when you're going watching this film, you're literally constantly referencing, going through your mental Rolodex of, oh, that's a bit Star Wars. That's a bit that, you know, that's a bit Nolan. That's a little bit Interstellar. That's a bit Gravity. You know, there's secrets of people hanging off the edge of spaceships. You know, Sox, as you say, is cracking. I found Taika Waititi a little bit under funny in this one, frankly. When you think of how good he is with Korg, it sort of isn't in the same ballpark as Korg's asides. But still, you know, very good. Very good by children's film standards. No. It's not going to set the world on fire, I don't think.
But that's the thing with Pixar. We do kind of judge them by their own standards. If this was another studio, I'd probably like it more. But you kind of go in and it is, as kids' films go, kids' animations, you know, and parents drag them along. The whole family's going to be entertained. And the standard of the animation is just, it's just different ballpark to anyone else out there. It's incredible. But we do have to judge Pixar by their own standards. And like Jordan said, I don't think they've done a great movie since Inside Out. And, you know, there's been quite a few since then. And they always hit a certain level. You know, they're always 3-4 stars. But you want them to be making masterpieces or classics of animation that would go down in history. And they, you know, their first few years, their first 10 years, they were almost doing it every time. So
yeah.
It's like, what has changed there? Because they're still taking as long, they say they're taking as long with the storytelling, you know, they still develop it for years and storyboard it all out and go through it again and again and again, every beat. And yet this one feels, you know, like I'm amazed that this is a storyline they hit upon and were happy with, were content with and said, right, this is what we're going to go with. It feels to me like one of the first ideas that would have been suggested and then maybe dismissed. So I don't know. It's a strange one.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because much of the brain trust is still the same, right? Like Pete Docter, Andrew Stanton, like all those people are sort of still there overseeing all these things happening. I mean, the one big person who isn't there any longer is John Lasseter, and you've got to wonder what kind of an impact he had on the studio while he was still there before he left in disgrace. The one thing I was like absolutely delighted about seeing this film though was actually watching it in a cinema, because this is the first Pixar film I've seen in a cinema since Onward.
And we saw it in IMAX, didn't we?
Yeah, it looks absolutely gorgeous in IMAX. There's a lot of stuff which is framed for that IMAX screen, so you get the full frame IMAX. And it looks incredible. Like those space flight sequences are absolutely astonishing. They're gorgeous. So I was really grateful for that. Even though I don't think it's one of the best, I do think it is actually one worth seeking out at the cinema rather than waiting for it to pop up on Disney Plus if you do have any interest in seeing it.
Yeah. And let's talk about the fact that obviously NASA was involved. So a lot of these sequences are sort of based in reality, you know, like the launch pads and the science of it. So it's sort of nerdy on that level. But also, you know, Pixar are, you know, not only taking swings in terms of story that you mentioned, Jordan, no spoilers, but they're taking swings in terms of representation as well on here. I think it's really exciting to see the diversity of the characters on here, and also, you know, gender diversity as well. You know, Buzz's boss is a woman. She is also a woman who's in a same-sex relationship. And that is, it's just part of the fabric of this film. And it's lovely to see that.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's absolutely great. And I think Pixar and Marvel in the last few years should both be applauded for that. But they've really got their game together. But in the last sort of 5-6 years, they've started to make their films a lot more diverse and sort of explore things like that. And it's vital that these huge studios do it, because you know, they're the ones that everyone gets their eyeballs on, that millions of people across the planet see, and you need to sort of not make a big thing of it. Like you said, it's just in the fabric of the film. You know, she's in a lesbian relationship, that's it. You know, it's great that they're doing that, and, you know, long may it continue.
Indeed. Okay, so we're saying it's a sort of three for us. It's worth seeing at the big cinema, the biggest screen you can get, and it's worth a trip with the family this weekend?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Definitely. Go.
Get to infinity and beyond with Lightyear then, which is out in cinemas this Friday. And as I say, do try and see it on IMAX if you can. Okay, next up, a little something for the weekend, sir. It's this.
I'm Leo, you must be Nancy. May I come inside?
Yes. So I've made a list of things that I'd like to get through. Number one, I perform oral sex on you. Number two, you perform oral sex on me. Number three, we do a 69, if that's what it's still called. Four, me on top. Five, doggy style.
That all sounds very achievable.
Have I booked enough time?
You want to do it all today?
Yes. No.
So this is good luck to you, Leo Grand. Who's Leo Grand and what's he up to? Or into?
He's got lots of good luck, I guess. No, this is Sophie Hyde's film. Sophie Hyde previously directed The Terrific Animals in 2019, written by Katie Brand, starring Emma Thompson as Nancy Stokes and Darren McCormack as the eponymous Leo Grand. It's a really simple setup. It's a pure two-hander set almost entirely in a Norwich hotel room. Nancy is a recently widowed ex-school teacher, very sexually repressed, claims to have never experienced an orgasm in her life. And Leo Grand is a young sex worker who Nancy employs to come to this hotel room and open her up to new experiences. I was going to say emotionally, but your mind went to a very different place.
Okay, continue.
emotionally, let's say emotionally and physically in that case, not least of which is her first orgasm, which is something she really wants to experience. But Nancy is a very typical British person in the sense that she is very awkward about sex. She is struggling with it because she has spent her whole life not having an open and honest appreciation of sex with her husband. Leo Grand is the complete opposite. He is relaxed. He has no shame or embarrassment about sex or his profession. And he is there to educate her in a way, in a sort of modern appreciation of what sex is and can be. And this I found to be very sweet, very funny, really warm-hearted, very sex positive. I love the fact that it was an older woman who is the central character who is going through this problem through the film. I thought that introduced an interesting dynamic to it. You know, we've seen a lot of, I would say, sex positive dramas and comedies about quite young people, something like Normal People, for example. We've seen that before, but we don't get this kind of dynamic on film all that often. I found Emma Thompson to be, it's a very... it's a very open and honest performance from Emma Thompson, I would say. She puts everything on the table. She doesn't hold back at any point. I was very impressed by the lengths that she was willing to go to in this film. And Darren McCormack, who I haven't really seen in anything before.
Peaky Blinders.
I haven't seen any Peaky Blinders, so I don't think I've seen him in anything. He was a real sort of classic sort of revelation. I found him just so charismatic, so charming, so handsome, just held himself so well on screen. And the fact that he's acting opposite Emma Thompson for the entirety of this film, you know, such an established, experienced actress. He's just as impressive as she is on every level. And I just found their bond like really sweet and really endearing. Katy Brand's script is really sort of peppery and fun. It doesn't drag despite the fact that, you know, we don't get any new environments basically for the entirety of 90 minutes. It's all set in these quite bland four walls. There's a mini fridge and a window. That's about it. And a bed. They occasionally go to the toilet. That's pretty much all you get outside of that room. But at the same time, I was totally engaged throughout, and I really sort of enjoyed their company. I thought I did actually feel like I learnt a bit about modern attitudes towards sex and what it might involve for someone of Nancy's age.
Yes, Jamie, did you like it? I mean, there's a big quote on the poster at the moment that says, you know, all men and women should see this. It shouldn't just be pigeonholed as a women's film, should it?
No, not at all. I thought it was, good, very good, in fact, for the reasons that Jordan said, that it's just... so good to see a film tackle something like this head on, and for the actors to do it, you know, so committed, so fearlessly. It gets that British attitude, or a certain age of Brits, their attitude is set spot on, the way that Nancy is always, just when they're about to start exploring and she's about to kind of investigate in a way and kind of try things she's always wanted to try and she's never done with her, never did with her husband, who's the only person she's ever made love to. And you know, he used to just climb on top, do his business, roll off, and that was it. You know, I love the fact that every time they're about to do it, she's so awkward and she's so intimidated by it all, that she makes small talk and she'll go off on tangents and kind of do anything to kind of redirect the energy of that moment. And it really reminded me of on Chesil Beach in a way, just that kind of awkwardness and just how... it can be absolutely mortifying, you know, where she just can't do it and she just feels so frozen. And he, Leo Grande, played by Darren McCormack, is like doing everything he can, both verbally and physically, but particularly verbally, to sort of relax her, put her in the moment, to get her past her shame, to get her past this embarrassment. And obviously during the course, I think it's set over about 4 days where, you know, it's not all in one room in one go. It's kind of, they have about 4 meetings where they come back to this room and sort of, she's hired him for another 2-hour session. And over the course of his time, they gradually get to know each other, because that's the other thing with this film, that he's obviously got his parameters in place, that he's presenting an image. He is Leo Grand. That's not his real name. You know, he's presenting an image. She's obviously gone there also at the start under a fake name, but that gradually gets chiseled away at, and they begin to get to know each other a bit more. and it kind of explores that. And yeah, I thought it was really, really good, really, really sex positive, like Jordan said, and a film that everyone should see, really. You know, not just, it may be marketed as a kind of grey pound movie or something, and it shouldn't be at all. It's, everyone should go along and have a look at it.
You don't have to be a woman or a woman of Emma Thompson's age to understand the issues that are here. It's about people who feel crippling self-doubt, who don't feel confident in doing a certain thing. And, you know, her journey is that she's taking a professional to help her learn to do something that she feels she would get enjoyment out of and she's missed from her whole life. And why shouldn't she? I loved that idea that, you know, you could be inspired by this to go off and do anything that you feel you haven't done in your life or that you're not doing your best version of you at. It's incredibly inspiring, not just in a sexual way, but in a life way. But equally with sex, it's a great film for kids to watch to understand about sex, to understand about consent, to understand about, you know, talking to your partner, pleasing your partner, understanding that it's a connection between two people, all of these things. But equally, you could learn a thing or two, even if you think you know exactly what you're doing in the bedroom. You know, I just think it's a really interesting film for everybody of every experience to watch. But I also really enjoyed the fact that, you know, it's casting sex workers in this different light as well, that this is a job that he has chosen to do. He's very good at it. He excels at it. He sees no reason why he shouldn't. And that sex workers are a sort of vital part of our society, despite the fact that they're often maligned in films as sort of tarts with hearts or gigolos. And that they're doing this really actually very important work that is both emotional and physical. And so I enjoyed that aspect of it as well. And I think Emma Thompson, I mean, really, she should be in the awards conversation at the end of the year, don't you reckon?
Yeah, she's terrific. Really good. I mean, it's hard to say when we haven't seen what there is to come, but given what we've seen so far, yeah, I wouldn't rule it out. Definitely not. I would also love to see some recognition for Sophie Hyde, because it's really not an easy job to direct a film like this, a two-hander set in one room. That's a very difficult job to keep it interesting and keep it engaging. And it's something that she has to do in a very sort of unshowy fashion in a way, because it's not a film where the camera's, you know, crawling up the walls or, you know, doing like CV shots through keyholes or whatever. It's all sort of fixed cameras and it's all just very simple but very effective. And I was sort of really impressed by that. And, you know, I mentioned it already, but Katie Brown's scripts, like, again, really, really difficult job. It could feel very theatrical if done wrong. And I don't think it does. It feels very cinematic to me.
You can't see those words on the page, which you could do with subject matter like this. It feels very organic. It feels very frank. It feels true to life. I know that woman. I feel like I know her and I've seen her in the street. And that is how she would talk if she was, you know, if Leo Grand was trying to take her underwear off. That is precisely how she'd react to it. So it feels brilliant in that way. And surprising for Katie Brand. I don't know that I would have expected this from her, given her output before this. So I'm excited to see what she does next, because clearly she's very talented.
Yeah, absolutely. Very promising screenwriting future.
Let's see Katie Brand and Emerald Fennell team up. that's my wish. So ladies, if you could make that happen, I want to see something saucy and sexy and frank from the two of them with a dark twist. That's what I'm looking for. So if you fancy a bit of Leo Grand, they are out in cinemas on Friday. Right, it's time for alternative line reading. And as always, it's somebody we've talked about already. One of their big lines, I'll do it in the style of Emma Thompson. I'm not looking for forgiveness and I'm way past asking permission.
That's very good.
So you're saying this isn't from Pride and Prejudice? Definitely
it
not.
It is not.
Okay. No, I know where this is from. This is my boy Cap in Civil War, I believe.
Yeah.
Talking to Thaddeus Thunderbolt Ross, classic scene. Love it.
It is Lightyear himself, and this is what it sounds like in real life.
And you think all's forgiven?
I'm not looking for forgiveness, and I'm way past asking permission. Earth just lost your best defender, so we're here to fight. And if you want to stand in our way, we'll fight you too.
Okay, so let's move on. Shall we get the party started? This guy can.
Who's that?
That's a mom and a kid.
Do you two dance?
We're not feeling it right now.
How about I bet you $300 I can get her on the dance floor?
I will give you $1,000.
So this is Cha-Cha Real Smooth. Jamie, who's Cha-Cha Real Smoothing? What's it about? Is it just about a dance? What's going on?
No, it's not at all. It's about a guy in his early 20s called Andrew, who's played by Cooper Rafe. More about him in a minute. He's basically, he's at that age a bit like Benjamin in The Graduate, where he's kind of lost and drifting, doesn't really know what to do with his life. And he kind of falls into his job of being a party starter at bar mitzvahs, where he's the guy who sort of gets everyone on the dance floor and gets the atmosphere going. And, you know, all those people who are kind of nervous at the edge of a floor, he makes them all join him. And he kind of has a real talent for it, that he's very likable and energetic and people go with it. So he starts doing this as a job and he's moving around various bar mitzvahs, seeing the same kind of faces. And during the course of his travels, he gets to know a young mother called Domino, played by Dakota Johnson, and her teenage daughter Lola, played by newcomer Vanessa Burghardt. And Lola has autism. Whenever she's at these parties, the last thing she wants to do is get involved and get on the dance floor. She'd rather kind of sit at the corner and keep to herself. But Andrew develops this real relationship with her, that he knows how to talk to her. She trusts him. He gets her involved. You know, she even gets on the dance floor with him at one point. And this really impresses the mother, Domino, who grows to really trust him. And during the course of a film, Andrew really feels he has a connection with Domino. He wants it to kind of develop into a romance. And she is engaged to Joseph, who is a lawyer. And she's a bit older. She's about 10 years older than Andrew, at a different stage in her life. And even though there definitely is a connection there and there is a spark there, she doesn't want to pursue it. But she's kind of quite happy in where she is in her life. She knows her own mind. So it's kind of, will she give in to the slight temptation? She's kind of attracted to the fact that he's kind of younger, uncomplicated. He has a certain freedom, which she obviously doesn't have in her life with all her responsibilities. So it's the kind of relationship between them and the kind of makeshift family or unit that they create in a way.
Did very well at Sundance. It was the Audience Award winner. Jordan and I saw it there. We loved it. Absolutely loved it. Did it work for you?
I really, really liked it. And it's the kind of film I don't always go for, because it's that kind of American indie that we see so much, where it's slightly kooky and it's slightly offbeat. And, you know, it reminded me of films like Little Miss Sunshine and The Squid and the Whale and Me, You and Everyone We Know. It has that kind of sensibility. And I can sometimes find that a bit much and a bit grating. And I can almost imagine them sort of writing it to make it really colourful and appeal to audiences. And that can be a bit off-putting. But this one is done with such heart and such honesty. It just really feels kind of authentic to me. And I went with it and all the kookiness just kind of engaged me and I found it endearing. I find Cooper Rafe, who is unbelievably talented.
Oh, it's insane. Though. It's sickening, isn't it?
He's like 25 years old. He's a writer, producer, director, star of this movie. He made his debut when he was 22 years old, again, as producer, writer, director, star of an indie film called Shithouse in the US, which was retitled Freshman Year over here, which again is just a really sort of great little indie, really engaging. He plays a sort of college student who, like his character in this, he's kind of drifting, he's lost, he's unconnected, he doesn't know what to do with his life, he feels a bit lonely at the edges, and then he connects to this other woman at college and forms a relationship with her. So it's quite similar in some ways, but it's just ridiculous that a guy in his early 20s can wear all these hats and do it so well. And, you know, I really like this movie. I just think it's a real crowd pleaser. You could be cynical about it if you want, some people will. But if you want to just sit down on a Friday night and have a damn good time at the movies and just really come out beaming, this is for you.
Jordan, what did you like about it? I mean, we obviously watched it in the festival bubble, and I watched it and I was like, oh, you've got to see it. And it wasn't one that was on our radar really initially. What did you love about it?
as Jamie has sort of covered there, I just found it just incredibly charming, incredibly funny. Really one of the funniest films I've seen this year. I don't think I've seen a funnier comedy this year. And I really responded to the relationship between Andrew and Domino. I found their connection. It has this sort of bittersweet, doomed quality to it, I guess you'd say, that you sort of know from the start that it can't possibly work out. You know, she's over 10 years older than he is. She has a daughter with autism. She's engaged to a guy. Like, it's just never going to work out. But you still just, you're just really pining for them to get together. And they seem to have this connection that you can't quite define in words, but you can just feel throughout the whole film. And I thought that was all just incredibly well observed. Like, that surely must have come from some sort of personal experience that Cooper Rafe or whoever has had. I know that he worked with Dakota Johnson on sort of developing these characters and the script. So it felt like all that was coming from a really authentic and really quite beautiful place. I love the sort of connection that Andrew has with Lola as well. He's ostensibly her babysitter, but they're basically like really good friends. Like, he is really kind and sweet with her. He knows how to talk to her and sort of bring her out and allow her to talk to him in a way that she can't even get on with people her own age, but she seems to really get on with Andrew because of the person that he is. He also has a really charming relationship with his younger brother called David. They're constantly talking about like girlfriends, and he's sort of preparing him for these later stages of his life. And he just treats people like little adults. He doesn't treat them like children, which I just found really endearing and charming. And again, Andrew has a terrifically warm relationship with his mother, played by Leslie Mann. She's bipolar and suffers from manic depressive episodes. And I thought Leslie Mann was absolutely tremendous in this film. She is an actress who often plays weird more often than I would like, but here she's a bit more sincere. And I thought she did a terrifically good job with that. I'm going to make you feel a little bit more sick now, Jamie. He was 23 when he made this.
Yeah.
He's 25 now, which is just outrageous. Like, how can you possibly be that talented, that young? Like, I could barely fill out a tax return when I was 23, let alone like
I still can't
direct a film.
Oh, yeah. I can. Yeah, I mean, I spoke to Cooper and Dakota and Vanessa, who plays Lola, for a feature on this, and it's insane that this kid, which Cooper is, basically pitched this film idea to Dakota and her producing partner, and so engaged with them that they threw all their eggs into his basket. And then Dakota sort of finessed the script. And, you know, he told me that a lot of the things that Domino says are verbatim what Dakota would have said in that situation. So I sort of enjoy watching this, seeing a little bit of Dakota Johnson. And, you know, I love her. I think she's so talented, and that the 50 Shades films were just not her at all. And that she is actually an incredible actor, and the nuance she brings to things, and incredibly playful and incredibly flirtatious. And you really see that element of her in this film. And the idea that you're talking about, this chemistry between the two on screen, is electric. She's very playful, but also an adult. He's like a grown man with a 5-year-old trapped inside him. It's like, he's just this puppy. He's like a golden retriever in a man's body, isn't he? And they sort of meet on this cosmic level that works, but is that enough? Yeah, it's incredibly romantic. It's funny. It's bittersweet. As you mentioned, the other characters written around this couple feel real. There's a stepfather that he has this antagonistic relationship with, but you can feel the love there as well. You know, his relationship with his mother is all over the place, but again, you can feel the love. And Dakota's character Domino has this fiance, which in any other film would be just this carbon copy bad guy, you know, the man you want to fail so that, you know, they can have a relationship. And he's not. He's this really very nice man. So it makes this all feel very much like a real situation. I just loved it. And, you know, it goes into all sorts of other, you know, aspects that I find interesting that Cooper sort of wrote about. He writes about, you know, female sexual health. He writes about mental health. He writes about, you know, what, you know, having a purpose in life and what should that be? And should you have one at sort of 23? I just think it covers a lot of things, and a lot of people could watch this and find something of themselves in it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've never like worked in a shop called Meat Sticks or anything like that, but I did feel
I fancied one though. I'd quite eat a meat stick.
They look delicious, didn't they? I did feel like I sort of recognized myself in Andrew a little bit, which is, you know, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
You got
thing.
His hair.
Almost, yeah. And almost Cooper's his beard hair. As well.
Yeah.
Sort of turning into Cooper Rafe. I'm just modeling my whole life on Cooper Rafe at this point. Yeah, I mean, as you said at the start there, Jane, you and I saw this back in January, and it's a film that's really stuck with me ever since. Like, I still think this will probably be in my top five of the year come the end of the year. I really, really enjoyed it, and I couldn't recommend it highly enough. It's almost a shame that it's getting sort of dumped on Apple TV Plus, it feels like. I don't feel like there's a ton of awareness around the fact that this is even coming out, which is a big shame because I do think it's one of the best films I've seen this year. And if you don't have Apple TV Plus, it's well worth subscribing just to see it, I would say.
We probably should mention, it has kind of split people, that all three of us are firmly in the pro camp. But
there are people in the office that loathed it.
There are critics out there who, you know, do feel it's really saccharine and even a little bit problematic. And, you know, so we should say that we're all massively in the pro camp, but there are people out there who don't like it. But personally, I'm on board with it. I think it's really, really terrific.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely people who have taken issue with the depictions of mental health in this film. I would say that Cooper Rafe has actually gone to greater lengths than a lot of filmmakers have previously. Obviously, he cast Vanessa Burkhart, who is an actor with autism, to play a character with autism. I think that's very commendable. That alone means, I mean, I don't have any experience in my family or friends of people with autism, but to me it felt like it was an honest depiction of what life with an autistic person might be like. Yeah, it felt like to me that he was doing sort of the right thing, or it felt like he was doing enough to me. You know, right. Other people with more experience may feel differently, but
I mean, it's no music. Come on, we're not getting into the realms of music.
Yeah, there are much greater crimes that have been committed in this field, I would say.
I'm pretty sure as well that he has said in interviews that, you know, autism and bipolar, he has experience with both of those, either in his family or immediate friend group. And, you know, he kind of drew on that. And to me, again, it did feel authentic, but I was watching it kind of almost ready to be offended in a way, as a lot of people are, because you could be really cynical about it and say they're just putting these characters in there, you know, be woke or whatever. You could be really, really cynical, but it did feel really authentic and carefully done to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I spoke to him, he has a younger sister with special needs who goes to a school for other kids with special needs, and a lot of her friends are kids with autism. So he has experienced those children. He's also experienced family members with mental health problems. So he is drawing on his own life. That's obviously not to say that it would definitely represent everybody's experience of that. But for, I think in his defense, it represents his own experience of that. Yeah. So if you're watching it, you probably shouldn't take it as a definitive portrayal of somebody with autism or somebody who is bipolar. It's just his particular experience and take on it.
I would sort of say as well, that's really only sort of one element of the film. Like, that's not entirely what the film is about. It's quite a rich, quite textured film. There's a lot going on here. And I would say that, it, you know, if you have any concerns about that, there are people who have written about it probably more eloquently than I'm talking about it now. But it felt to me like I was in fairly safe hands with that stuff and all the other stuff, the relationship stuff, the comedy. I thought it was just handled just so deftly, so well, just a really enjoyable time.
Indeed. Okay, so if you fancy a really enjoyable time, Cha Cha Real Smooth is on Apple TV Plus from Friday.
I will say the one thing that Cooper Rafe can't do is give his films good titles, because Cha Cha Real Smooth, terrible title.
But he then said to me that he doesn't think about titles, he just gives them the titles because he thinks titles are silly. They're difficult to, you know, assign to films that are about such big subjects. But then he started to say, but you could say it's about dance moves, and that when you're negotiating romance and life, it's the moves that you use, and the ones that feel right are the ones that you go with. And maybe you've got to get in step with somebody to find the person for you. So he managed to, as he was saying, it was a silly title and it meant nothing, to say it meant everything.
The dance cha-cha is made up of lots of little steps, isn't it, as well? So you could even extend it to that, but this is quite a small film. And it's sort of delicately navigating your way around people in relationships. It kind of feels right in that way, but I do agree it's not the greatest title. Although I do like the title Shit House to his debut. I don't think they should have changed it in the UK the freshman year, which is just really kind of...
Well, wait to see what his third one's going to be, because no doubt he will be doing a third one with a nonsensical title there. Right, it's time to switch gears completely. It's this.
Je vais rien faire sans toi, sans ton accord, rien. De toute façon, c'est à toi qui l'a demandé.
C'est un mauvais père.
Mais je l'aime. J'aurais adoré l'avoir comme ami.
Alors aide-le. Comme une amie.
En France, c'est pas possible.
Alors qu'est-ce qu'on fait ?
J'aurai contact avec une association suisse, mais il faudrait aller là-bas.
Très bien.
So this is Everything Went Fine. Has everything gone fine, Jordan? Is everything going fine in this film?
Well, that would be a spoiler, but things are not going great for Sophie Marceau's Emmanuel Bernheim, because her father, Andre, is in hospital. He has suffered from a stroke, and it's very much a kind of stroke that renders his life practically not worth living in his own eyes. And he expresses his desire for Emmanuel to assist him with his suicide. This is after a long, drawn-out stay in hospital with Andre's sort of road to recovery not going particularly well. I should say, before I get any further into this, this is directed by François Ozon, one of the great French auteurs, written by Emmanuel Bernheim, based on her own novel. So there is sort of a basis in truth in this film, which I was sort of surprised to learn, because actually quite a lot of this film felt a little bit almost unreal to me. But the thing that this film does, which I was sort of impressed by, is that it shows the experience of caring for a parent at the end of their life in quite an unflinching manner. Yeah. Andre, the father, he seems like a quite cruel man. I don't think that we're supposed to think that Emmanuel had the best childhood. We get these occasional sort of... it's hard to tell if they're flashbacks or sort of dream sequences where we see a young Emmanuel and her father is not the kindest, shall we say. It's clear that he's suffered through his life from depressive episodes. The same is true of his wife, played by Charlotte Rampling, who is suffering from a form of Parkinson's, we're told, in her older life, and is also suffering. And the entire film is essentially... Emmanuel and her sister Pascal initially caring for their father as he struggles to recover, later learning that he wants to commit suicide, essentially, assisted suicide, and then initially helping him reluctantly with the hope that he will eventually change his mind. So yeah, it's sort of in the grand tradition, especially in France, of mm-hmm. films about elderly, infirm parents. Michael Haneke's Amour. There was a film at Cannes this year called Un Bon Matin, directed by Mia Hansen-Love, which covers this exact same subject matter. The difference with this film is that it just focuses exclusively on caring for the father in later life. Their whole life is taken over by it. We don't really get an insight into what these characters' lives are like outside of this situation. It's very sad. It's deeply upsetting at points. It's really tough to watch at times. I would say possibly that other filmmakers have done it better. I'm not sure exactly what this added to that sort of small subgenre that I haven't seen elsewhere at this point, but really well performed. I haven't seen, you know, Sophie Marceau, obviously a former Bond girl, in a great deal of films, I have to say, outside of The World Is Not Enough. But I thought she was great here. Just very sort of vulnerable, like completely strung out, wit's end with everything that's going on. She, you know, she's going through an extremely tough situation where, you know, she cares for this dude. She says she loves this man, but she hates this man because he gave her such a tough childhood, but she still loves him. And letting go of him is still extremely painful. So that was a really difficult sort of needle to thread, I thought. But I wouldn't say I was completely blown away by this, but it is extremely well made, extremely well performed. It has everything in the right place, but I don't think it does anything particularly exceptional compared to what we may have seen before.
No, I agree. we've seen sort of this thing with Blackbird recently, even the father to some extent, which I think did it better.
Yeah.
Jamie, did you enjoy this? Did it do it for you? I mean, it's a hard film to say you would enjoy at any rate, isn't it? Because it's, you know, a difficult subject matter.
Yeah, I think I liked it more than you guys in terms of what I admired about it was the kind of acting and the relationship. And the fact that it was such a pragmatic film that it had no sentiment, it had no melodrama. You know, it does have moments of tenderness, but it's so low key, and it just kind of focuses on the practicalities of getting it done in terms of this man, this very stubborn 85-year-old, he decides he wants to end his life. That's it. You know, no one can argue with him. The daughters aren't going to even begin to try and argue with him because he always has his own way. He knows his own mind. So they then set about getting it done. And in terms of how you do that in France, because it's illegal, so they have to arrange, you know, to go to a Swiss clinic and do it in such a way that it won't come back on them, that they can be tried for it and even face prison time for it. It just goes through it in a really sort of by the numbers, unsentimental fashion. And I think Sophie Marceau and André Dussolier, who plays the 85-year-old man who wants to end his own life, you know, their relationship, it's just so like he is on his best day, he's kind of cantankerous and irascible. And on his worst day, which is many days, he's emotionally cruel. He's verbally abusive. And yet, despite not sanding any edges off his character, that, you know, he says so many horrible things to her, and he's such a sort of mean-spirited man in many ways, but I still came to care for him, which is really bizarre because I didn't feel manipulated into it at all. And yet, as the movie went on and kind of approached its end game, as it were, I really did kind of care for him. And like his daughters, I was hoping that he would reverse his mind and maybe find something in life where he decides, actually, you know, I do want a few more years of this. I'm not ready to give it up yet. So I thought it was good. And Francois Ozon, you know, again, he makes it in a very unfussy way, the way it's shot, the way it's lit. It's just kind of really practical, no nonsense. And I kind of admired that as well, that it sort of didn't milk the subject matter at all. So it's not a film I adored. And because it plays it so straight, it's not a film where you get greatly emotional by, you know, you don't come out kind of really feeling you've been through the ringer. But I did kind of admire it, and I thought it was good. And Francois Ozon is not a director I particularly warm to. He's kind of this French auteur that everyone loves. And I do admire the fact that he's so versatile. He turns his hand to every genre. He does all sorts of things. And he always hits a certain standard. You know, he's obviously a very good, fine filmmaker, but he's not someone I ever kind of adore his movies. And I kind of feel the same with this, that I liked it. I think it's good, bordering on very good, but I didn't adore it.
It's elegant and well-made and well-acted. And yes, a very elegant film, but not necessarily one that you will think about a great deal after you've watched it.
Yeah, like you said, you mentioned the father, and, you know, I was thinking of Vortex, the Gaspar Noé film earlier this year, and for me, it doesn't have the impact of those movies where I really felt quite sort of crippled by them afterwards, and they stayed with me for weeks and weeks and weeks. But I did admire this. There was a lot I took from this where I thought that's a brave movie. And I've actually, without going into it too much myself, I have in my own life been through something similar. And a lot of it sort of chimed for me, and I thought it was done. I could kind of feel the truth in it, that it is, you know, based on the writer's own life. And I kind of felt, yeah, I recognize quite a lot of this.
Yeah. The thing that I struggled with a tiny bit is the fact that even though it is based on Emmanuelle's own book about this subject, about her own experiences, this is a very well-off family. So they don't have to worry about things financially, which I don't think is the experience that most people have going through this situation. They say at one point that it costs like 10,000 euros or something for him to go through this assisted suicide procedure. And, you know, they just don't even bat an eyelid at that. People don't work. People live in these nice houses. Like, the fact that they don't have to make a living while all this is going on just isn't a concern for anyone, which sort of made me think, you know, this isn't going to be the experience that most people have, and it isn't the experience that most people will have had. You know, they've had to work, they've had to make sacrifices to go through this experience. So I felt like, in that sense, it felt almost like too glamorous a version of this type of story. Like, it didn't feel raw in that sense, in that same way that they just have this one issue that they have to deal with, and that's it. There's nothing else going on in their lives, which didn't entirely work for me and took me out of it a little bit. But that said, I could appreciate the fact that this was coming from a place of lived-in experience, that there were things that people could connect to in a universal sense outside of that.
I didn't feel that as much, because I kind of feel they tackle that subject on the head. Like, they don't go into it a lot, but that line where they do say, oh, it costs £10,000 or €10,000, the father says, like, oh, I don't know how poor people, or I don't know how people, you know, do it. Mm-hmm. And it does sort of cover that.
It has self-awareness, doesn't it?
Yeah, it has awareness that they are a privileged family, and the money isn't a concern for them, whereas for many people, if it's something they did want to do and did want to respect their father's wishes, they just wouldn't be able to do it, and they'd have to, you know, get on with it and wait for him to die, and he'd have to wait for himself to die, and it would be even worse, you know, it'd be horrific. So they tackle that, and I do feel there was a bit more going on that I found the relationship between the sisters quite fascinating as well, because even though the daughter we really follow, Emmanuelle, played by Sophie Marceau, even though we see from the flashbacks and her relationship with her father that it's not a good relationship and he's been pretty horrible to her all her life, there's still a certain degree of love there, and you can see that she is the favourite daughter. Whereas the youngest daughter, you know, she's never in the flashbacks and she's kind of totally ignored. And it's the older daughter, Emmanuelle, she's the one that he asks, you know, to arrange this and help him with ending his life, which again is a kind of show that she's the one he trusts or loves more. And the younger daughter just has to get on with it. And none of this is really spoken, but you can kind of see it between the sisters that even though there's a great deal of love there and they do support each other, there's something between them as well. They both kind of know the situation that Emmanuelle is the father's favourite. So I think there's stuff there. It's just, you know, it's done in a very kind of sort of cold way and not in a sentimental way, and nothing is spelt out. It's just really sort of just below the surface.
Well, should we recommend this for people to go and see at the cinema this weekend?
If you like films where people are constantly storming out of rooms and throwing their coat over their shoulder, then definitely, because that happens about 10 times.
Does, true.
I would recommend it. It depends how many times you go to a cinema. If you're going to go to a cinema once a week or something, then I'd choose something else that we've discussed. But if you're someone who, like, yeah, you like to get down to cinema two or three times a week, I think this is worth your time and worth your money.
Okay, so that is Everything Went Fine, and that is out in cinemas on Friday. That's it for this week. Just to remind everybody that our new cover of our new issue will be dropping this week. Watch out for that. It's a good one. And we'll be back next week with more of the same. But before we go, there's time for a listener question. And this fits in perfectly with Lightyear. What was your favourite toy from a film as a child, Jordan?
I know exactly what this is. I had the Ghostbusters firehouse.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously from Ghostbusters. The best thing about this, though, was it had a sort of grating at the top of it, and you got the slime with it that you could pour down this grating, and then all the slime would kind of drip through the firehouse.
I bet your mum loved that when it was all in the carpet.
I imagine it was disgusting. I was obviously too young to care about any of that, but no. I have very fond memories of that even to this day. It's probably in my parents' attic somewhere.
You should find it.
Dig it out. Yeah.
Have another go with the slime. Jamie?
I saw Star Wars, the original Star Wars, A New Hope, although it was just Star Wars when it came out. I saw it when I was 5 years old and got lots of toys from it. And I clearly remember I had only a tiny little, you know, it's probably about 3 inches high. I had a figurine of Luke Skywalker and one of Han Solo and one of Darth Vader. I used to just constantly spend hours and hours in my bedroom with just the three of them having various fights with their lightsabers. So that was probably my favourite, although I should say that the one I always favoured and the one I always made sure won all the fights was Darth Vader. That he was my favourite character when I was five, which probably says a lot about me. So it's a bit worrying, really. But
there's a whole psychological sort of delving to go on there.
Yeah, there is. And then the other thing I just want to mention, because it makes me really nostalgic, it's not a toy, but a book. I had the novelization of E.T. Mm-hmm. when it came out, which was a really good novelization, at least it was to a 10-year-old. You know, I was 10 when I was reading it, and I read that book several times, cover to cover, and just adored it, and I still have it to this day on my bookshelf, a very battered old paperback copy from, like, 1982.
Oh, I used to love those novelizations because it used to take so long for films to come out from the cinema to then be able to get them on like VHS.
Yeah.
So that was the way that you could treasure them if you couldn't get, you know, back to the cinema and see them. You could just read them again and again and again. I had one of Back to the Future for that. And I also had an E.T. soft toy that I used to put in the basket of my bike and ride around with a little blanket around it. I mean, I hoped that one day it might take me off and I'd fly over my house on the bike, but that never happened. But and also the Millennium Falcon had that, and all of the figures, including Nappy Man, which Jordan will correct me on what they're actually called, but that's what we called them. Nappy Man.
The guards at
Jabba the Hutt's palace.
Oh, the Gamorrean guards.
That's it. Nappy Man. That's what he was called in our house. And also, I mean, I don't know about you, but I really always wanted the piano from Big that you could jump on and play a tune.
Mm.
Why did that never appear in my stocking? But that would have been amazing.
Have you had a go on that at FAO Schwartz?
Of course.
That's a rite of passage if you go
absolutely
to New York. You've got to have a go on the piano.
Yes.
Is it just different in the film? It wasn't as impressive as when I went. I thought it was a bit lame, to be honest.
I think it's obviously not the same. I think it was bigger and more impressive in the film. But also, you are an adult now, so it would have been a smaller piano to you now.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
And on that note, shall we say goodbye and await next week when we'll be back talking about Elvis and Black Phone, two very different films. But for now, say goodbye, Jordan.
Goodbye.
Say goodbye, Jamie.
Bye.
And it's bye from me. Goodbye.